Welcome, folks, to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. We're going to claw our way through the cultures of consciousness today, talking with Antonio Lopez, World Bridger Media, about his new book, The Media Ecosystem. And, you know, it's a funny thing, when the question of how to think about, I'm sure we'll be getting to this, how do we use our understanding of nature to understand human beings. It's a primary problem that all of us face. On the one hand, we are obviously part of nature. Where else would we have, what else would we be a part of? And even our most seemingly unnatural human creation will mimic, shape, and manifest some of these natural patterns, whether it's our own simian anthropological urges, whether it's the patterns of traffic or information flowing through the internet. But at the same time, there's always this sense that there's something different about us, something like there's some crack in nature that we inhabit that makes up who we are. And a lot of politics happens around where you put that line, where you say what's natural, what's not natural, what can be fixed, what can be rejiggered, what do we have to submit to, what do we have to embrace, what do we want to embrace. And I think Antonio's new book is fascinating for the way that it brings together both the media part of the equation and real understanding of eco-psychology and the larger natural frame. But before we bring on Antonio, we'll bring on our co-host here, Maja Dau, calling in from Los Angeles, the most ecologically sensitive part of the planet. Not just kidding.
It's very politically correct.
How are you doing, Maja?
I'm doing good, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good. You live sort of in, you live in Glendale, right?
Totally.
And is it smoggy there?
The air is very gnarly. I mean, even just in Hollywood, and if you go inland from the beach at all, it's pretty crazy. And there was one time when I was flying in from the plane, and you could see the smog, and it literally looked like someone had taken a paintbrush and just, like, dabbled, like, brown, sticky goo all over the city.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing, because you can, you know, you like, we had a guest on, I think it was Kelvin who was talking about it. You know, he teaches in L.A., does all this energy work. A lot of people come to him concerned about healing and balance, and they're, like, asking him questions about, you know, what's the right, like, you know, floor wax to use that's the most
right.
Eco-friendly. And he's like, dude, you live in L.A.
Yeah, that was really good.
But it's just a funny compromise we all have to live. You know, on the one hand, we strive for balance and a less toxic lifestyle, and then we're, you know, almost by necessity, although not entirely by necessity, you can always hightail it to the hills, and people do, but most of us choose or find ourselves in these much more kind of compromised environments, not just physically, but also just, you know, mentally, as we kind of move between different frames of things that taken to their full extent.
Well, and it's
are
funny
problematic.
Because I always think about that in terms of getting sick too. You know, like you mentioned, we are just walking around with all kinds of toxins in us all the time, like poop. I like to think about poop. You know, you never get sick from your own E. coli. You get sick from other people's E. coli. Like when you go to Mexico or you go into an area when the toxins are different than the ones you're used to, then you get like infiltrated. So that's the thing with the ecosystems, right? It's like if I'm in LA, in this air, and it's in me, then like my body's cool. But if I went like somewhere else with those toxins, then I'm out of the ecosystem, and now I'm going to get all jacked up.
Well, that's a great example too of how we can kind of blow it, because in our little stories, from that perspective, we might be like, oh, everything is hunky dory in my homeland of LA. It's those Mexican climes that are filled with weird
right.
bugs, and it's a dirty place, and it's filled with germs. And you're like, no, man, it's just their germs.
Yes, exactly.
Not your germs. So, well, anyways, L.A. is a good thing to think about as we plunge into this discussion about ecology and media. But for that, we'll bring on our guest today, Antonio Lopez. Hey, Antonio, welcome to the show.
Hey, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, it sounds okay. Antonio sent me an email earlier warning me that because of he's in southern Italy in a small town where they're celebrating the feast of San Rocco, which is apparently a rather noisy paganish affair. But I don't seem to hear any explosions or street noise at the moment. Is it a quiet moment in the festivities?
Well, we lucked out because the drumming procession passed by as you guys were giving the intro, but there's more of the procession coming, and I don't know what is going to be there, but, you know, we'll just have to wait and see.
Well, it sounds kind of fun. I mean, could you just give us a little taste of what this intense celebration is like?
Sure. About an hour and a half ago, I went to the church where they carry out the statue San Rocco, and it was just thousands of people out filling the streets. It was very festive, very wonderful atmosphere. You know, we're in southern Italy. It's pretty hot right now, but we're next to the sea, so we have this nice sea breeze blowing in. And then as they brought the statue out, they shot off all these fireworks, paper confetti exploding everywhere. It was very intense, very exciting. A lot of energy coming out, people clapping and cheering, and a really strong sense of actually love that people are expressing towards this representative of a saint. You know, it's a Catholic saint, but I imagine that these kinds of celebrations go back thousands of years.
Well, I mean, in a way, it's kind of a nice backdrop for some of the discussions that you have in your book and your other work, which is about how, you know, as humans, we culturally remember nature and perhaps earlier parts of our own existences when we were more embedded in the flows and fluctuations of nature. And, you know, now we're in this much more complicated way. We're not even sure what the term means. And sometimes it even seems like the term gets in the way of what we really, really want to say. But then we find these places in our world today where there's a kind of memory. And if you look through the cracks, if you look at through the right perspective, you can see some very ancient fertility exuberance. And it sounds like this is one of those kinds of events.
Yeah, absolutely. This reminds me a lot of what Lewis Mumford, the great historian and critic of technology, wrote about how even if you encounter in our very modern technological society a solstice ritual, this is harkens to our ancient past. And we have this ancient selves present everywhere, even in the media. I think that the popularity of Avatar, for example, tapped into some deep-seated feelings of connection with nature, because I know a lot of critics will argue that this movie was just basically a virtualization and a falsification of nature reality, and maybe even a glorification or romanticization of tribal cultures. But the way that people responded to that film, I think, was very deep and profound. And I just look at the way that how people felt so drawn to that sense of connection that the characters in that film had with the nature spirits and the animals of that planet, that is sort of a re-excavation of something that maybe some of us thought was lost, but it's always ever present.
Well, that's a great place to kind of launch into some of the issues, because, I mean, if we just stay with Avatar, it's a really handy kind of object to think about, because, you know, almost everybody's seen it. It was enormously popular, and as you say, it has this, it carries with it this profound ambivalence, because if you like accept the, you know, the circumstances of the story, if you go with it, if you release yourself from critical distance, you know, many people, some of whom were, you know, eco-psychologists, some of whom were, you know, ayahuasca hippies, some of whom were, you know, tons of whom were just normal folks from wherever, you know, were embedded in their modern technological lives with no particular interest in nature or tribal ways, nonetheless found themselves resonating with this, you know, very romanticized, but also in many ways moving depiction, not just of a kind of idealized tribe with their rituals and practices, but also just a way of being, as you say, like a way of literally plugging into the flora and fauna, harmonizing culture with a certain sense of grander pattern that is expressed through this physical environment. And yet, at the same time, you can look at that same film and take a step back and go, my God, this is just a colossal piece of bad, of false consciousness, an engine of the sort of military entertainment complex that seeks to distract us from the consequences of the very system that allows these fantasies to be produced. I remember when I saw Avatar, there was ads beforehand for the army, and it was on a big screen that had all of these. It kind of demonstrated the technology beforehand. There was one of those little prequel things to show off the Dolby sound, and it was almost like, look at our technology, look at our virtual powers, and yeah, here's an ad for the army, and now we're going to tell you a story about these gentle, but fierce figures. And so as a media ecologist, as someone like you, a media activist, somebody who's very critical of corporate hegemony, who's very sensitive to the ways in which bad, sort of inappropriate forms of consciousness are aided and abetted by our media landscape, how do you deal with that contradiction with something like Avatar?
Well, it seems that you may hear some music in the background. I think things are kicking into gear over here. What I found is that no matter how you approach the problem, it's always going to be contradictory. I mean, we could talk about computing as a way of raising consciousness and connecting people politically and socially, yet at the same time, computers are producing very unjust circumstances. They're very unecological devices. And our computer or the Internet produces as much CO2 emissions as the aviation industry will double with the increasing of the iCloud, or the cloud, excuse me, the data clouds. So, there's everywhere you look, it's contradictory. But on the other hand, these are the tools we have at our disposal. I mean, I think of the image we have of Earth that was taken from Apollo, and that image could be argued helped galvanize modern environmental movement, but at the same time, the technological military system that produced that image is very serious. I mean, NASA, which produced that, used a lot of resources and is one of the most probably anti-nature and toxic organizations on the planet. Yet at the same time, we now depend on NASA for climate data in order for us to understand the seriousness of our climate crisis.
But what strikes me about the power of your turn towards ecology as a metaphor, as an analogy, as a way of thinking about media is actually helps us through this contradiction. Because sometimes, I often find myself thinking about media and activism and these kinds of contradictions, like about computers, perfect example, clearly amazing organizing tool, also a tool of surveillance, giving data to our masters, also a technology with a very serious environmental footprint. Oh my God, how do I think through these things? It's sort of, you kind of run against a sort of block, and sometimes it prevents you from thinking or moving forward because the contradictions are just too crazy. And while that's always important to acknowledge, it also seems like the idea of ecology itself also helps you or encourages you to look at situations, political situations, technological situations, as having, it's an ecology. There's multiple things going on. They flow together. They interact. Sometimes they conflict. I mean, they conflict in the sense that, the way that different animals in an ecosystem will go after each other. I mean, it's part of the balance in one sense, but in another sense, chaos and disruption are also part of the flow. So the thinking about things with an ecological mind frame where there are multiple centers, there's a topography of difference that you know runs against each other. It's always fluctuating in emotion. In a way, it helps us kind of deal with that, with those contradictions.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just look at our old bodies. We're full of bacteria, viruses, and parasites. A lot of times, those things, depending on what the state of our personal body's ecology is, either can help us or hurt us. So it's all about finding some kind of equilibrium. And so as you talk about, as you mentioned, that any kind of ecosystem has all kinds of counterbalancing factors. What happens, though, is that certain kinds of elements can overpower others when the system becomes deprived of diversity. You know, that's one thing that really affects ecosystems, and I talk about that in parallel to between nature and also technological systems. If we have, if we wipe out diversity of consciousness in our media systems, that's going to actually influence culture in a negative way. So we need to encourage diverse ecosystems of ideas, of symbols, of technologies, of energy systems. And if those things at some point balance themselves out, they're fantastic. Unfortunately, we're in a situation where my vision of the planetary media ecosystem has predominantly been colonized by corporations that have their own particular agenda. So I don't feel like we're at a point where things will just balance out on their own. We certainly have to be more active and push for a better system.
And that's something that's very interesting to me, because even if you just look at it, you know, like mirroring a system of nature and how this happens in nature, how like one thing will become predominant and take over, then the result is a crisis within the ecosystem. So it's always seemed so stupid to me. It's like a virus that kills its host, right? Where the single thing, which is taking over all the other diversity, does it to like kind of gain more power and get more all-consuming, but then it just kills itself. So I've always been like, well, why do you think it happens, like with corporations, for example, that they get so big and then they are no longer sustainable, so then they crash or they get bought out by other people? Like, why do you think that keeps happening? Like, why do you think there's not enough consciousness within even the dumb, like, corporations or media moguls to see that happening?
Well, the critique has been that we inherited basically an economic system during a time where we had a lot of ecological abundance, you know, going back, let's say, 200 years. So the Industrial Revolution, even though it was environmentally very detrimental, England was able to recover because the planet is so big, and corporations, through the way that they structure themselves, can externalize to different parts of the world those kinds of expenses, and I'm including in that kind of accounting the expense of destroying an ecosystem. They could do it up to a point because there was enough ecosystems around the world that they could just keep destroying, but now we've hit the limit of that system. And unfortunately, the way that the system is structured, it's not enabling those companies to have more foresight, more vision. In fact, you know, they have to report a quarterly profit every, what is that, 3 or 4 months. That doesn't help for planning for, let's say, the Native American idea of 7 generations down the line.
Right.
So there's a built-in structure that's causing a lot of this lack of foresight.
Well, before you mentioned about how the situation is such that it seems, you know, unlikely that the system is going to balance itself just by the organic process of, you know, technology developing, that actually this is a time when tremendous intervention and, you know, conscious reconstruction and resistance and a variety of forms of action are needed. But I'm curious, as you see it, I can think of kind of two ways of thinking about that. One is getting a very clear idea of what's wrong and, in some sense, combating that, you know, whether it's certain kind of corporate practices, whether it's the structure of the corporation, you know, whether it's the pollution of the media stream, et cetera, et cetera. But then there's another way that I've kind of come to think about partly by reading your book. You have a chapter in there called Gardening Media Ecosystems. And in that view, it's less about putting forward a different agenda, Like, I have my agenda. My friend over here has their agenda. We're going against the corporations who have their agenda. But instead, what you want to do, or in addition to that, is to create environment, cultivate diversity in an environment, a kind of diversity where in some sense you're not in control of all of the agendas, and that you almost want multiple agendas to be on the table, where what's more important is the diversity of the system rather than having your own view of what the proper agenda is be the thing that's driving your activism. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I know, exactly. I mean, one of the points I make throughout the book is the importance of keeping systems open. And open ecosystems are the ones that tend to thrive. And when you close systems down, and that's where they start to fail usually. So part of the problem with the old form of activism, which was, I think, critiqued pretty heavily by through just the actions of the Occupy movement, is their tendency to sort of operate in traditional frames, to sort of argue against basically political discussions that have already been established by the system. And so those discussions get very narrow. And it's really hard to maneuver within that kind of for example, the Sierra Club, those kind of organizations, they're basically responding to the agenda that's already been set up by the corporations or the government. And what happens when you open up spaces is that you create possibilities for new agendas to arise, new possibilities could come together, new connections could come together. And I've done a lot of reading about what the conditions in which new ideas arise and where creativity takes place, where culture transforms and evolves, is always under conditions of openness, where you have sort of different inputs coming in from different perspectives, different backgrounds. And this has actually been even scientifically proven, that solutions are more likely to get resolved when you have as much diversity as possible among the people that are trying to solve a problem. Now, the people that were engaging in Occupy were criticized for not having an agenda, for sort of having this open process, an open-ended process, being like these assemblies where consensus takes place. It's very cumbersome, it's time-consuming. But the thing about these spaces is that they transform the people that are in those spaces. And that, to me, is very important. They're pedagogical. And so what I'd like to see is media that is pedagogical, in the sense that when you engage that kind of media, it transforms you. And I'm going on my experience. I'm glad you opened up with Los Angeles, because a lot of my influence for the ideas of this book came about as a punk rocker in Los Angeles when I was a teenager. We didn't know what we were doing, but we had enough diversity among ourselves to kind of figure it out. And we were able to create transformational spaces so that when we went to a punk show, we did a zine, that changed us. I think more contemporary examples could be like Burning Man, or, I don't know, other kinds of, I'm sure people would think of raves or different things that have happened over the past 30 years, where people encounter media makers and revelers, et cetera, and that experience has transformed them and made them into a better person, and they learn new skills, they got new ideas.
Well, in a way, it's like redefining what we mean by pedagogy. Because if you say, tell me, well, I think our media should be better pedagogical tools, I can think of that in the old school sense as well, which is like, oh, what we need to do is to teach people about the environmental consequences of their every action, you know. And we have a lot of information like that. You know, we with a little bit of work, not even very much, we can, you know, find out about the negative impact of almost everything we do, so much so that some people just get almost frozen by this, you know, education that we now have about the consequences of our actions. But that's very different than what you're talking about, which is something that, while it may provide very grim truth as part of the process, indeed it's almost requires to kind of wake people up from whatever, you know, pseudo dream they're involved with in terms of their everyday lives. You've got to shake it up, whether it's the possibility of greater, weirder times, or the possibility of a different way of dealing with energy or food. You got to kind of wake them up. But also within that is space to learn that you can learn, you know, to learn how to learn, to open up what it means to learn. So it's not just about taking in a framework or taking in a set of information, it's actually changing the way that you engage, which is almost like a different kind of education, a different kind of pedagogy. And so what are the things that you see help lead us towards that second place, that place where we're really learning? I mean, you used examples of Occupy and you know, punk rock. Early punk rock's a great example in terms of media practices, all sorts of situationists and Burning Man even to some degree. But what are the elements you think that are really important for people who are like trying to explore this stuff in terms of thinking about how their media can have that richer kind of educational force?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I have lots of ideas of how people could certainly engage and become more conscious and learn and participate in these kinds of projects and new media pedagogies. I don't know quite how to get them there. I still am trying to work that out. You know, I'm an educator, so I work with young people. So within my own my own realm, I'm sort of trying to lead people in that direction. But I think through media like radio shows, and like your radio show, for example, writers, artists, websites, networking, people are able to share information. There's certainly people trying to create alternative networks that are not just Facebook or Twitter, but these are networks that are about conscious evolution. For example, the Evolver people are trying to do that with social networks, try to share knowledge through creating regional spores where people can use the network to connect with each other, but then they arrange ways to actually gather in person. These are the kinds of things that I would really advocate.
Well, and it's true. It seems like just in all those things you're talking about, those run in smaller micro ecosystems, right? And I think, like with what Eric said, it's a different way to learn things, which has to kind of be a little experiential. And I think the only way you're going to kind of educate people about some of those consequences or threats is if they experience them in their own, like, little world. And, I mean, it's, like, it's the same on every level. Like, with a corporation, they might, like you said, they don't have the foresight to see that threat until, oh, my God, it's happening to them, right? You can tell people all you want about all the damage that's happening to the ecosystem in Antarctica. Do they care? Because they can't see it. It's not part of their little realm, right? But if you can infiltrate on a smaller level with those smaller groups where you can see it and experience it within, like, your family, so to speak, then it has more impact, and you'll actually feel the consequences and be able to kind of, like, have more understanding of them, I think.
Well, you know, chaos theory, which deals with dynamic systems and complexity, one of the points that comes out of that theory is that all change is local. So,
right.
You know, there's the proverbial butterfly flapping its wing in Brazil causing the tornado in Kansas. I feel that the countercultures, the subcultures, play a very important role. And so those will certainly contribute to expanded awareness, consciousness. I think education has to step up. I work in a university environment, and I think that the kind of courses I teach are probably an exception. You know, the kind of dominant themes and ideas that are being perpetuated through universities are the kind that are shoring up the system. But if there was some way to push for better reforms in terms of, like, let's say, media literacy. Media literacy is a proven technique that works very well, that kids like it. It's obvious that they learn, it's been studied, it's been documented, yet it's not part of the standard curriculum. So one thing that could be sort of put in place as a way of helping people get closer to these ideas that we're talking about is pushing for reforms in education that allow for things like media literacy. But on the other hand, I'm somewhat skeptical of the kind of agenda that you see coming out of the government in terms of education, because everything's being privatized right now, and if it doesn't turn a profit, then it's not considered to be valuable. So again, it goes back to how do you lead people to the river to get them to drink? It's a very tough question. I think that all the very small interventions that are going on in different places will hopefully at some point add up. I mean, certainly, I think maybe 2 or 3 years ago, none of us could have imagined that the Occupy movement would just explode. Now, I know that it's been somewhat muted lately. People think that it's disappeared, but it's also sort of gone in waves around the world. You have the movements going on in Montreal, Mexico City now, there's a bunch of stuff going on in Europe, the Mediterranean, North Africa. It seems to be going around in waves around the planet. And certainly media has played a big role in facilitating that, but it still comes down to what is the experience that are people having locally. I mean, I kept watching what was going on in Egypt with, like, Tahrir Square, and I thought, well, you know, Tahrir Square, that is where people are being transformed. It's not being through the computer networks that are linking up the information about the revolution. It's people going into that physical space and having that experience, that revolutionary fervor, that is really transforming them.
Well, this is great. You brought up a lot of, like, totally fascinating media political points that I want to dive into in the second half. We got to take a break right here. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Masha Dawu. We're talking with Antonio Lopez, author of The Media Ecosystem, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Masha Dawu, and we're here with Eric Davis, talking to Antonio Lopez all about ecosystems and corporations and nature and behavior. And Antonio, earlier you were talking about some of your history in Los Angeles with the punk movement, and this is something that's interesting to me and how that influenced your book, because I feel like a lot of people, like, say, for example, who became part of the Occupy movement, people will form and conglomerate groups, kind of like, you know, they'll form a corporation. It's all people that they come together and formulate these little ecosystems, whether it's on one end of the spectrum or in a rebellion to, like, a group that formed before. Like, it's all groups and countergroups. And to me, it seems like there's a lot of, like, insider-outsider business going on there, right? So, like, in the punkers, it's like a group of outsiders that then all became, like, exclusive insiders in the punk rock movement, right? So I was wondering if, like, in your history, like in other paths, like growing up, were you part of like a cohesive community when you were younger and kind of felt like what that was like, or were you an outsider or sort of an insider?
I think that's a good question. I'm probably a fairly typical kid from the, I was born in the 60s, but grew up in the 70s. Like all my cohort members of the punk scene, most of us grew up in divorced households, a lot of dysfunction, a lot of abuse of therapy, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yeah.
And so because of the dysfunction of our families and our environment, the for me at least, my direct experience was the punk scene became a surrogate family.
Hmm.
And so, like all families, you know, there's going to be problems, and there are ways that people define themselves. And, you know, in the early days of punk, we were very strict about who was in, who was out. I mean, you had to look a certain way. And so a lot of that kind of behavior was very contradictory, you know, contradictory to the utopian values or the anarchist values that a lot of people espoused. Yet at the same time, we really supported each other, learned from each other. And so I've seen this in parallel with the way people talk about hip hop, you know, like the grassroots hip hop, and so to answer your question, I've always been from a somewhat dysfunctional background, but I had opportunity to participate in cohesive communities in the form of actually a Native American society, because when I was working as an educator, I was going to Indian reservations in New Mexico and Arizona, and working with people that have been severely stressed and work who have survived sort of, you know, horrible historical circumstances, yet they've somehow been able to maintain a lot of their ritual practices. Families very strong in those communities, and going in as a media educator and also sort of a punk rocker. Also, I mean, I'm a retired punk, so to speak, but I'm still a punk rocker. Brought those values, the DIY spirit, the do-it-yourself spirit, with me into those communities, and I really learned a lot from those situations. And in fact, I would say that the environmentalism that has entered into my process and has entered into the way that I think about the media ecosystem was really inspired by my experience of working and living with Native Americans.
And you went in there as an outsider. Were they accepting of you? Like, do you feel like you infiltrated that group, so to speak? Like, were they just, like, down with sharing all their stuff with you?
Not everything. I mean, they're savvy enough to know that, you know, there's certain things that I'm not allowed to do. But, in fact, oftentimes, because I was doing video workshops with their youth, they say, okay, you know, you can work with them, but you just can't point the camera in that direction. And they wouldn't say why, you know, but I just had to respect that. And as long as I respect the rules, then they were down with me. The thing that I experienced working with Native Americans is that they don't judge people by the way they look or the way they speak or hold themselves. It's what's really in their heart. And that's something that I learned a lot. It was very inspiring. They're very generous and would share. They would have these feast days. You could go and walk into a stranger's house and eat a meal with them. As long as you show, like, a good heart, then they're cool with you. Mm. But if you're, you know, if you're going to go there and have an agenda and not listen, that's the thing that really will turn them off immediately is if you don't listen, because white people have a tendency to just go and talk and not listen. So I was actually I had an opportunity to do a lot of projects because I had peers in the media education movement who would just go tell them what to think or what to do, and they would just tell them to take a hike. Mm. So because I was respectful and I was sensitive to what their needs were, the doors were open to me. So that was, I think, something that really made a difference.
It sounds like from that experience, it wasn't just the impression you had of how some of these communities were able to maintain certain connections with tradition and with, you know, alternative, what from our perspective are alternative ways of being, but also just the your own experience of realizing that in order to be able to connect, you needed to kind of get out of the way a little bit. I mean, that seems to be one of the principles of a more kind of ecological approach to media, is that you're not always leading forward with your own perspective and your own agenda, that you have to also be cultivating a space where different perspectives can come together and where other people are allowed to kind of have a place to express, or other cultures express the way they want to express themselves in this environment. It's not necessarily who they ultimately are, because you don't really see that. There are things you don't know. There's things you're not privy to, you're not going to be privy to. But there's still a way of creating a space of interaction that can be really, you know, kind of productive. I mean, the way that I think about, like, programming this show is, you know, people use the term curation a lot, but it really is a little bit more like gardening, where it's like, okay, we've had people kind of from this perspective, let's balance it with this, a little bit more science, a little bit more politics, how to create, like, a garden with different things kind of going on. And it seemed like for you, you were able to interface there because you could get yourself, in a way, kind of out of the way.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you. I mean, I think gardening is the perfect metaphor. I mean, I think I'm lucky in the sense that I'm bicultural, so I've already, you know, I'm half Mexican, so I've already coming from a sort of a multicultural balancing of different, trying to get different perspectives in my own psyche, in my own life, straightened out, and how do I accommodate the different worldviews that I have grown up in, and then balance that with the world that I'm engaging, and I think, so that certainly helped out a lot. And then also, I think it helps to have just a spiritual commitment to mindfulness and to self-awareness. And, you know, that's something that I also talk about as being part of the solution, is that even though we don't like to talk about in the field of, like, let's say, media studies, which is where I have my academic background, to talk about spirituality and looking at the way that we respond to things, to meditation and mindfulness, these are skills that I think are absolutely important. And if people work on cultivating themselves, they can also be better at cultivating the gardens that they're engaging, because then they can be sensitive to the responses that they're having to the environment that they're working within, And I think that's very important, is learning how to listen not just to yourself, but also to the cues around you.
Well, it's also that, I mean, you talk about attention in the book, and of course that's a big element of our discourse around media is our own attention, which is a place where the media system and our individual consciousness kind of overlap, and in a very direct way. It's like, where is our attention lying? What tricks and techniques are being used to capture that attention? How do we become conscious of that process to the degree we can? How do we redirect it? So we'll talk a little bit about, like, either, you know, your own practices, your own experience of how to develop a more supple appropriate kind of attention in relationship to the sorts of media landscapes that you surf, like all of us do.
Well, sure. One thing that I should mention, because maybe your listeners aren't familiar with the idea of how the point you're making about how the economy of media functions in terms of attention. And so what happens is that essentially, you know, all the media that we encounter is mostly free, and it's free because the time we spend engaging that media is sold to marketers. So, you know, the space that advertising occupies, that space is sold to advertisers based on our eyeballs, the time we spend watching something. And same is true with the Internet, with Facebook, Google, all these things that we use. The time we spend our ideas, our energy put into that is then sold to corporations for the most part. So it's important for people to be aware of that, and oftentimes it's not something that they really are familiar with. And once they understand that, then they can at least have the choice of how much do they want to parcel out their attention to the companies. And also, I think that it's possible to resist the way that these companies try to get our attention through the way that we engage stuff. I mean, there's some great essays by Bell Hooks, where she talks about how African Americans talk back at media. Mm-hmm. And if you've been to a movie theater in Oakland, people are just yelling at the movie, like, "How? Don't do that. Hey, you can't do that." No, and, talking to the characters and talking to the TV is actually a way of taking some of your power back, because you're actually creating a dialogue where a dialogue is not allowed to exist. So that's
well,
and
otherwise you're like hypnotized. Like, if you watch most people when they're taking in media, it's true. Like, they're not engaging. They're not participating. So that's like, I mean, it's like brainwashing or indoctrination. It's very true that they're empowering themselves by doing that.
Right. So exactly. So I think one thing that I encourage people to do is, definitely talk back to the media. Also, making media as a way of becoming more mindful, because when you make media, then you understand how media function and how, like, producing your radio show, making a website, making a zine. I mean, I learned everything. This whole process started for me by making a zine. Getting a typewriter, getting glue, getting scissors, cutting stuff up, pasting it on paper, going to a Xerox machine, making copies, stapling it, and trying to sell it to people and give it away, whatever. That taught me that it's possible to have a voice. So that's another thing I think is very important, is that people often see media as some kind of mystical space, a magical place that if you somehow can imbibe it, it'll give you power. But it's not really that magical, in my opinion. It's just there's a lot of nuts and bolts behind it that people don't really understand. And once you know how it works, it has less of a mystifying effect. Other techniques, one thing I do with my students is that I require them I teach in Rome, Italy, which is a great city to get lost in. So I say, okay, you have to get lost. This is your assignment. You cannot take your smartphone. You cannot take a pen or a pencil or a map or anything. And I just want you to go walk through the city, experience what it will allow you to experience, and then write about it, and then we talk about it. And an interesting thing that people report back on, well, as to be expected, I'm working with 19, 20-year-old kids. About a third of them will really hate the assignment. They're very neurotic, and they miss the fact that they can't get in touch with their families, or they expect that someone is going to need to talk to them, which is a new kind of neurosis, I think, that from the modern age. But there's a small percentage who come back and say, "Wow, for the first time, I smelled Rome." Now, can you imagine? We don't think that a cell phone cuts off our senses. But in a way, that's exactly what is taking place.
Well, it's so funny that you're using that as an example, because we just spoke with John Graham, and he was talking about one of the surrealist games would be to do just that. Back in the day in France, one of the games they would play to open up their consciousness was to get lost in a city or have to follow someone else's like little point. You had no idea where you were going, and the result of that actually had a consciousness-expanding experience.
Well, and I have to say that I stole this idea from the surrealist and the situationist. So
oh, okay, good.
You're right on.
That's a perfect example. Well, I got a question for you. We got about 10 minutes left.
Sure.
And I'm really curious, in terms of a lot of things we've been talking about, the issue of diversity, the issue of cultivating attention, the issue, meaning that there is a sort of psycho-spiritual process that we can engage in as a way of changing our relationship to media and ameliorating some of its negative factors. Also in terms of this question of making media, and you know, you as you are well aware, very much showed your age with this invocation of making zines. I mean, I you know, did a school newspaper, and the same thing. It was, you know, paste and cutting and laying out, and this whole kind of relationship with the material, physical process of making a publication that in many ways is obviated today. And so, you know, when a 20-year-old now who's quote unquote, who's making media is obviously making media almost certainly in an entirely digital environment, and some of that media making, it very much involves social networks. And that's really my question here, we're still in this sort of Web 2.0 moment of the rise, explosion, manipulation, transformation through social media, Facebook, Twitter, the whole thing. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. Even just cell phone networks of friends, you know, on the go on a Friday night, have some element of this kind of quality. So how do you come down on where we're at with social media, its positive, its negative effects, in terms of some of these questions of diversity, of getting your hands on things? Because just to give you a tiny bit of my view is that, you know, I have very mixed feelings about it. And in for every step forward, I see a lot of really, really problematic things that are coming up. Maybe that's true of technology in general, of media in general. There's no way out of this devil's bargain. But I also have some real issues with it, and I have no doubt that you've been thinking about this a lot, and I'm curious some of the thoughts you have.
Well, I have to say that I, like you, have some serious questions. I would have to. I hope that you won't see this as a cop out, but I'm going to say that I'm agnostic, and I say that I'm agnostic because, on the one hand, I do see a lot of really positive, beautiful things going on. I think that a lot of the social movements that have been happening over the last year and a half were facilitated because of social media. On the other hand, I am really very deeply concerned about the privatization of this commons, this cultural commons that I talked about in the book. The internet that we grew up with, and now I'm starting to show my age again also, was an open internet, and it was a kind of a free-for-all place, and it did have sort of the flavor of zine culture, DIY. There was a lot of old sort of punks and hippies and visionaries using the net, and it had that kind of utopian quality to it. I'm getting more and more pessimistic about those qualities being maintained simply because the corporations have so thoroughly colonized the internet. And, you know, I use Facebook, I'm not going to add Twitter, but I'm not also at the same time going to pretend that these are sort of public services. You know, these are corporations that are mining information. They're very likely have ties to probably military in some levels in terms of supplying or at least creating a space where people can be monitored very easily. So I'm very skeptical of that. I was very concerned about the way that WikiLeaks was essentially censored by private companies. So for those of the listeners who are not familiar, what happened when WikiLeaks released the State Department correspondences, they were essentially cut off from a number of services by Amazon, Apple, Visa, MasterCard. And if we as activists are trying to use this so-called public space as a place for connecting civic engagement, and that space is increasingly privatized and controlled by corporations, then it's less and less going to be a free space. So I'm sort of on the downside of it. I guess you could call me a optimistic pessimist. Is that possible?
Well, you're in Rome where Gramsci's buried. So what was it? You know, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will.
Right. Exactly.
You know, and I have the same sense, is that even if I can get pretty concerned about a lot of the issues you're talking about, the role of surveillance, and even more psychological issues, the way that we internalize surveillance, the way that we internalize the construction of a public identity. I mean, it's one thing to say privacy is over. In some ways, that's a good thing because it, you know, frees us up in this way. And if their dirty laundry is visible as well, then it actually helps the overall ecology, which is an argument I have respect for if I don't entirely trust. But at the same time, it's really transforming who we are and how we represent ourselves. I mean, more and more of our self-representation in society is through this media or these media. And they encourage a lot of things. You can see it. You can see the braggadocio. You can see the refusal to acknowledge certain kinds of difficulties. You can see the fear of silence, the fear of loneliness. You can see if you want to be neuroscientific about it, the dopamine rush of that little update or that little nugget of data as a feature that distracts and erodes certain kinds of thinking that require more time, more contemplation, slower movements. I mean, all these things are very clearly happening, and there may, you know, we may be just having to go through it. One of the things I really liked about your book and your work and the way you talk about things in general is that you're, unlike a lot of political people who are critical of the media or who engage in an activist way of media, there's very much a space in what you're talking about for the heart, for spirituality, not as some kind of escape, but as a way of waking up in the midst of our very distractible, very difficult existences. And it seems to me that that's the way the optimism keeps it. That's the way you can still keep being optimistic, is if you see and encourage and cultivate that side of the thing, even as we go forward into, you know, in some ways a very, very scary, you know, potentially dystopian situation. And I'm curious for you, just as we wind up here, how, when you lose heart with this whole media world, what do you turn to? What kind of gives you inspiration, or what gives you a sense of the possibility?
Well, I think that one of the most important things that media does is that it really amplifies empathy. And so, if despite all the negativity that we just spoke about, the one thing that I could say that is very positive in the development of the global planetary media system we have is the capacity for empathy to resonate. And I mean, we can see how this takes place whenever there's a natural disaster, like an earthquake in Haiti or the tsunami, and just how it really brings people together. And media really helps facilitate that. I talked about how Avatar sort of tapped into a lot of people's deep connections with ecology. Those were all based on very deep human experiences of empathy, and I think empathy is what will save us. So there's oftentimes I come across examples in media, someone does a remix very innocently, yet it really moves me because it really stirred something in me where I connected with other people, I connected with someone else's experience, with someone else's reality. Yeah, so
great. We're going to have to end it right there. So thanks for being on the show, Antonio.
Thank you very much. It was wonderful. Thank you so much.
When World Bridger, what's your website?
People can just go to the book's website, which is themediaecosystem.com.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks a lot from me and Majid Ali out there. Keep your minds open.